exit number 13629, reel 2.
Mr. Hosier, reel 2.
Yes, J site was out of the brook and up towards the perimeter. Unfortunately, the ground there, as it was in many areas of the Western Desert, was sheet rock. People think about deserts as being sand, but a lot of it is rock. And you couldn't dig into this, so everything was above ground. The gun positions, the instrument positions, were surrounded by sandbags, which is not too much protection. The radar unit was detached from the rest of the battery. And the problem with the radar unit was you were sitting in a plywood box, literally. You couldn't build sandbags too high because it interfered with the reception. So you're 6 or 7 feet above the ground on sheetrock with a quarter of an inch of plywood at your back. And the mental strain in the raid was fairly severe because when bombs hit this rock, they just splintered and flew sideways. And it was quite a nervous strain. The gun positions were better off in that they could build the sandbags as high as they wanted to, as long as the gun could traverse. But certainly the radar people were under quite a bit of strain.
You were backing up some specific infantry unit, were you?
No, we were part of the anti-aircraft defence of Tobruk. You see, the Air Force was non-existent. There were absolutely no air cover at all. And Tobruk depended on the anti-aircraft, which was, you know, reinforced continually as the siege went on. I'm not sure how many guns there were eventually, but probably something like 60 to 70 anti-aircraft guns. And we shot down well over 100 enemy aircraft and damaged probably 200 or 300.
What would be the pattern of your duty on a typical day in action?
Well, the worst day we had, there were 48 air raids. That's one every half an hour. The German planes had to come 17 miles from El Adam Airport. We could, in fact, once they got off the ground, see them falling up. And it was a question of just counting how many were going to be, 50, 100, 150. And then they would come in. The Ju-88s, Stukas particularly, dive bombing, with their sirens screaming. And it was just very noisy, very nasty, and I suppose quite dangerous. That was the worst day, 48, but you could guarantee, at least 20 air raids a day. And then you also had Bardia Bill, which was a long-range gun way, way away, just indiscriminately shelling all the time. The Germans just sort of cocked it up a bit, fired around, moved it right a bit and fired another one, and that just went on all the time. So we were fairly severely plastered day after day.
Were any of the guns in your battery hit?
Not in our particular battery. We did have, on my gun, in fact, because I transferred eventually from the radar onto the guns, and I was on number 4 gun. And what we had was a premature in the barrel. The life of a 3.7 barrel was 800 rounds. Between the supply drops once a month on the moorless nights, anything you ran out of, it was just hard luck, you had to wait. And my gun had fired something like 1,100 rounds. And we still had to wait until the next moonless night for a new barrel. So it was either carry on firing or just sit there and take it. So we carried on firing. And we could hear the shells sort of wobbling in the barrel and whooshing through the air instead of making the normal noise. And then suddenly there's the most enormous crack I've ever heard. And the shell exploded in the barrel. It took about 4 or 5 feet at the end of the barrel, bananaed out with jagged steel bits. And bits of steel flew all over the place, with remarkably few casualties, actually.
But some people were injured.
Yes, but we were very lucky. Nobody was killed. And that's amazing, really, with all the stuff that flew out from that gun. But that's, you know, that was the problem. You couldn't get replacements. You couldn't sort of ring up and say, send up a new barrel.
What about living conditions on your site, apart from the salty tea?
Well, as I say, you couldn't dig down. You looked for a place where you could scrape some sort of hole and got it as deep as you could. And then you built up with sandbags. There was a wealth of corrugated iron all over the desert. The Italians had used a tremendous lot of it. So we put corrugated iron on top of the hole and piled sandbags on top of that. We also, to book being evacuated by the civilians, we pillaged iron bed frames from the town. So we had a bed to sleep on. So from that point of view, there was a degree of comfort. We also discovered that the Navy had used Tobruk caves as a store for their supplies, including rum. And there were literally hundreds of 2 gallon jars of neat Navy rum. And we were given an official issue of an eighth day. And normally in the army, you've got to go 3 days without sleep in the frost and cold and wet and everything before you get a tot. We had an issue every day. And that was a help.
How did you do for water?
We were rationed to a pint a day. The Royal Engineers made a fortune. They had the plant to distill seawater. And they sold distilled water at £1 a pint, which you added to your pint issue. And so you had 2 pints. Being very cynical, one bright bloke somewhere in the War Office decided it would be brilliant to save shipping space by sending us dehydrated vegetables and apple rings and stuff like that. But, of course, the only thing we were short of was water. They burnt beautifully, actually. But dried onions make a real good bonfire.
Did you burn the lot?
Yeah, used them whenever we could, yes.
So the money that the sappers were collecting was going into their private pockets, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
So, did it mean that you got body lice because of the lack of water?
No. What we did, there's a little bay in Tobruk which we christened Brighton Bay, and sections took it in turn to go down there for half an hour, or half a day rather, and loll around naked on the beach, having put all your dirty clothes in the Mediterranean with rocks on it. There's little tide in the Mediterranean, but just sufficient to move a little bit and clean the clothes. And then the salt water across it, we washed in. As far as, you see, out of this pint a day you're given, you're supposed to shave and keep yourself clean and everything else. And you become very adept. I had a little tobacco tin. Most of us had a little tin of some sort, which held a few ounces. You lit a candle underneath it. You made a wire frame, a little candle, and that heated the water in which you shaved. But having shaved, you didn't throw that away. You had another container, and it went. And it built up until you had enough to wash a pair of socks, that sort of thing. You never threw water away. Doesn't matter what state it got into. There's always a use for it. And you become paranoid, really, about water. When we did get relieved, chaps would sit at a turn a tap on somewhere and just sit and watch it run. Chaps would buy 10 bottles of beer and look at them and drink, and perhaps drink 6 of them, and then get up and leave the others. That didn't matter. They had owned 10 bottles of beer. It gets to you. Even now, I can't bear to see water wasted. A dripping tap infuriates me.
You said that there was this particularly bad day from the point of view of enemy attacks.
Yes.
In your period at Tobruk, did things gradually get worse from the point of view of the pressure from the enemy?
Well, yes, it got worse. Then towards the end, towards the December, when the siege was lifted, it eased a little bit in that the Germans were otherwise occupied, you know. The Eighth Army was coming up the desert and they had to move people away from Tobruk. So that did get a bit easier. And a few days before the end of the siege, the tanks and the infantry on the perimeter actually broke out of Tobruk and made advances into the desert, driving the Germans around the perimeter back.
This was in December 41?
Yes. It's hard to say exactly when the siege was lifted. Several times contact was made between the garrison and the 8th Army, but the line would be cut again. So it was a bit fluid for a day or two. But it was roughly, I suppose, from somewhere about the 10th to the 12th of December, we could finally say, right, Tobruk is relieved, the Germans have gone that way.
But this was a confusing period.
It was confusing, yes, yes. Yeah. The other major thing that I haven't mentioned was the departure of the 9th Aussie Division. They had been there since the beginning, and they were just incredible blokes, you know. But eventually, I think there was political pressure from Australia. In fact, I'm sure there was. And it was decided to relieve them. The Navy did a marvellous job. It's all in that book there. They, in stages, took the whole 9th Australian Division out and brought General Anders' Polish Brigade in. To the British in Tobruk, the difference was that under the Australians, we'd been getting fresh bread. They had their own bakeries. We'd been getting butter, Australian butter. And the food was not half bad. as soon as the British took over, it was bully beef and biscuits 3 times a day. You know. That's the difference.
How did the Australians and the British get on in Tobruk?
Tremendously, yes. There's a letter of appreciation from Brigadier Morshead, commanding the 9th Australian Division expressing their gratitude and support and appreciation for what the anti-aircraft brigade did.
Did the Australians have a different way of going on from the British?
Yes. Informal, I think, is the tactful way of saying it. They were marvellous fighting troops, but the spit and polish of the English amused them. You know.
Did you have much contact with the Poles?
Initially, a little bit, because when they landed, they came up and they would say, you know, where's the enemy? And we would say, well, there's an Italian battery over there. Where's the nearest German? Well, there's a sentry up on top of that hill there. And they turned everything they had on the German sentry. They didn't want to know about Italians. They just wanted to kill Germans, you know. They were even buying ammunition, you know. If they used up their quota, they would go and buy it off British troops, you know. Anything to kill Germans. They really hated.
How did the British react to that?
Fine, yeah. Fine. We didn't like the Germans either.
But your attitude was different.
Well, we had a job to do, that was it. Pointless to waste a lot of ammunition on one sentry.
Any other incidents that you can recount from Tobruk days?
The one rather unfortunate thing was that everything came in on the moonless nights, and the Navy had done a marvellous job to get the stuff up there. And the troops were waiting for all the goodies and so on that were brought up at considerable risk to a lot of people. Unfortunately, dockers anywhere in the world, I think, are noted for being light-fingered. And certainly, there are a tremendous amount of pilferage going on. Every soldier was supposed to get an issue of 50 cigarettes a week. That was down to about 30 by the time it got up to the troops in the front line. A lot of pilfering went on, which is a great shame.
Now, you were lucky in managing to avoid being captured in Tobruk.
How did
that come about?
Well, they kept us in Tobruk after the siege was lifted. We were still part of the ACAC defence of Tobruk, and it was still an important port. So we were kept there, on top of which our equipment was pretty well worn out. My gun had a cracked base and so on. So we just stayed there as part of the ACAC defence of Tobruk until the following June, when Rommel counterattacked. And I think, this is hearsay, but I think it's true, the Navy said that they would not countenance another siege of Tobruk. And the main body of troops in Tobruk at the time were the South Africans. And there was not anything like the will that there was before to try and keep it as a port. So we were ordered out and told to make our way back down, and there was a whole load of stuff going on the only one road across the desert, and it was jam-packed with the troops all going back towards Egypt. The Guards Brigade was still in Tobruk when we left. They fought their way out with considerable casualties and then made their way back. But the South Africans surrendered the day after we left. Tobruk was surrendered.
What had been your relations with the South Africans?
I saw nothing of them at all, actually.
Now, I think here we can put in another point about Egypt, a comment you made to me earlier about Lady Esther.
Yes, we're talking about the morale of the troops. Okay, so there were brothels in Cairo, Alexandria, and probably other main towns. A lot of the troops had been out there a long time. Some of the regular troops had been out there probably 2 or 3 years before the war as part of the garrison. And, you know, okay, there were brothels and they were used. But when Lady Esther came out and looked around, she went back to England and made remarks which were published in the Daily Mirror, of which we got copies, warning the women of England to beware of any man who came back to England with a sunburnt V on his chest from his open neck, because he's bound to be riddled with syphilis and clap and anything that was going. In fact, you see, if you've taken the brothels away, then no doubt at all, they probably would have been riddled with all that stuff. But the brothels were inspected daily by army doctors who were obviously absolutely intent on keeping everything free from disease. So she was talking rubbish, but also it didn't do a great deal for the morale of the troops.
Did you have comrades who were incapacitated through VD?
I don't know of a single one.
Would they have been punished if they had got VD?
Well, yes, it would count as a self-inflicted wound.
Now, moving on a bit further in the war, in 1942, can you tell me about the arrival of Montgomery and the effect he had in Egypt?
Yes. I think most of the troops recognised the name Wavell, but he, of course, was pushed over to India. until Montgomery, if you'd ask the average desert soldier who's running things, they just wouldn't give you a name. When Montgomery came, within 3 weeks, every man, wherever he was, had seen and been addressed by General Sir Bernard Law Montgomery, standing on the bonnet of a jeep and saying, "Gather around me," and that sort of thing, and talking about knocking him for six and all. But they knew him, you see. And they also had confidence that he wasn't going to commit them to anything that was anything like suicide. He was going to move when he was ready and when he had the certainty or near certainty of success. And there was, he was under enormous pressure from Churchill, from all sorts of people. And he steadfastly refused to go until he was ready. And the troops respected that. And when we went, of course, that was it. It was 3 months from Alamein to Tripoli, just like that.
Where did you see Montgomery?
certainly in that, in the Alamein area. I saw him several times. I can't remember exactly the site. But certainly after we'd gone back from the surrender at Tobruk and been re-equipped and had some leave and so on, we eventually wound up back at Alamein in support of the army there, still on 3-7 guns. And I saw, definitely saw him there. And I saw him a couple of times during the advance, because we followed the 8th Army up as, again, part of the anti-aircraft defence. And occasionally, I mean, we even stopped in Tobruk for a time to defend the port again. Eventually reached Benghazi and with the defence of the port there. And it was from there that I was actually sent back to Middle East Octu.
What would Monty do on arrival with a group of troops?
well, he talked to the officers, But then he'd climb up on something, and it was usually the bonnet of a jeep, and wave his arms, you know, and the troops would all gather around. And then he'd hector them, you know, in his inimitable style. Hmm. He just built confidence that he knew what he was doing and he wasn't going to let them down.
Were there any people in the 8th Army who didn't like Monty, do you think?
I never found one, no. No.
Can we go on to the Alamein battle, and can you tell me in detail what you did in it?
Well, as I said, we were part of the anti-aircraft defence. So, again, we had many more aircraft than we'd had before. But at times, you know, they couldn't be in the air all the time. And with the 37s and Bofors and things like that, we were attacking the aircraft. We did, in fact, do a certain amount of field artillery because the 37 has a longer range than a 25-pounder. And, you know, we could pick a site and perhaps surprise a German battery or something who thought they were out of range of our guns. And then, of course, it was the infantry and the tanks, of course, that really fought the battle. And the breakthrough was, what, about the 4th of November, I think it was. And everything started moving.
Which part of the front were you defending?
We were in the north, nearer the sea.
This is where the Australians and the 51 Div were?
51 Div, yes, that's right.
Did you witness the famous barrage?
Yes, oh yes.
What was that like?
Well, the greatest show on earth. I mean, it seemed to go on forever. It was one long succession of gun flashes and the rumble of thunder, which seemed to go on forever. Tremendous noise.
How much confidence did you have at the start of the battle that it was going to succeed?
Total. Montgomery had that knack. You know, the fellows knew that he wasn't going to go until he was ready, and when he was ready, it was going to work. It was perhaps naive, but there was an enormous faith in Montgomery.
What was the pursuit of the Germans like after Alamein?
Well, extremely fast. Obviously, hiccups, pauses while something was cleared up and all the rest of it. But the timetable, you know, was very rapid indeed.
Did you see many German and Italian prisoners on the way up?
Yes, thousands. The Italians would be marching fully armed into captivity. You didn't even bother to disarm them. You know, the Germans were a very different kind of fish.
Would the Italians say anything to you as they passed?
Usually sort of smiling and joking, you know, happy to be prisoners. They were good Italian units, but I didn't see any of them. I think